is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome to America's Web Radio. As the owner of the station, I always get to do one thing, and that's about the only time I'm on anybody's show, but that's when we start a new show. And I'm delighted to be starting a new show today on America's Web Radio called The Doctor's Lounge. And this is going to be one of the most interesting shows, I think, going. It's an inside view. It's what the doctors are saying to each other, talking about what's going on in politics and obviously in medicine as well. But I am delighted to say we want you to tune in to America's Web Radio, The Doctor's Lounge, with Dr. Hal and Dr. Mike. And that's it. I'm going to turn it over to them.
Thank you, David. I'm Dr. Hal Schurz.
And I'm Dr. Michael Karuchek, and you are listening to America Web's Radio's newest show called The Doctor's Lounge, and we thank you so much for listening. So what is The Doctor's Lounge? Well, every hospital has one. It's a place where doctors go in the hospital to get a cup of coffee, have something to eat, and to talk to each other. So in the lounge, we discuss all kinds of medical and healthcare matters amongst ourselves. So our intent with this show is to give you a little window into those private conversations that the public doesn't otherwise hear, the so-called sort of inside baseball sort of thing. So we'd like to thank David Moxley and America's Web Radio for their generosity. They have donated some airtime for the time being to our sponsor, the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, to help us get off the ground, and you will hear a lot more about this later.
We'd like to invite you into the Doctor's Lounge today and listen to us explore timely topics in healthcare, including issues with healthcare reform, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and specific discussions on medical matters like cancer or new treatments and other controversial healthcare-related matters, such as the topic that we're going to focus on today, which is the issue with veterans healthcare. But first, we would like to introduce ourselves so that you know who we are and why we are the ones talking to you. So, Mike, why don't you tell everyone about yourself?
Well, Hal, I grew up in Pittsburgh, so I'm a big Steeler fan. I graduated from the Duke University School of Medicine in 1988 and went from there to Vanderbilt University in Nashville and spent my next 7 years there learning how to be an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and a voice specialist. I've been in practice in Atlanta since 1995, and I see professional voice users, some of whom you would probably recognize by name. I also do a lot of thyroid surgery and a lot of sinus surgery, including a lot of the new office procedures available for that sort of thing. My other big thing is health information technology. I designed a lot of our practice's electronic medical record system and have done a lot of writing and consulting outside of the practice. And for fun, I play baseball and play guitar, neither of them very well.
Well, it's a good thing we have a voice specialist on the radio here. It's something that we can use.
So Hal, tell us about yourself.
Well, I am a pediatric urologist. I'm from New York originally, if you couldn't tell that from my accent. But I've spent time in San Antonio, Texas, in San Diego, California, and most recently in Atlanta, Georgia, where the show originates from. I'm a partner in Georgia Urology, and I am the managing partner of Georgia Pediatric Urology, and I'm on boards at the Children's Hospital in Atlanta. I train the residents and the fellows at the university, at Emory University and at the Children's Hospital. So I have an appointment at Emory University and at Children's Hospital. I write articles, and just like you, I'm active in practice, and this is our extracurricular activities, which is basically to take a role in trying to educate the public in healthcare matters. So what I did 5 years ago was founded Docs for Patient Care, which is a physician organization that was intended to educate the public and speak out against what I saw coming, which is the government intrusion into healthcare. And everything that we're seeing today was predicted, and things that are going to happen, we've also predicted, and I think that we can pretty much say categorically that everything that is happening for a reason. It's that the ultimate goal is to get government more involved in health care, ultimately single payer, I believe, and I think that most people like yourself also believe that. But yes, we started Docs for Patient Care to try to organize doctors to speak out, to educate their patients, educate the public, and to get more involved. And that's one of the things that, you know, talking to doctors, doctors just don't want to get involved.
And they're very reluctant.
They are. And they're more interested in just getting their work done. They work hard, but it's hard for them to, you know, do two things at once, to focus on the career and then also to be a little bit more socially responsible and take an active role in trying to lead the way in healthcare. And unfortunately, I think that's why we're in the mess we're in today.
Well, agreed. And I think, you know, both by self-selection and by the nature of our training, we were taught that medicine was the calling and that there really wasn't a lot of bandwidth to do much else with your life except be sure that you could be the best patient care provider that you could be. Modern times force us to think beyond that, unfortunately. But it's difficult.
Well, you and I both have dispelled that myth because I think we are really spending all of our spare time doing things that I believe are important for our patients and for healthcare in America in general. And so Docs for Patient Care now has launched a project that we're going to formally launch this month, which is our Docs for Patient Care Foundation. And it's a 501c3. It's a non-for-profit that is an educational organization to teach the public about healthcare freedom. And that's the mission of our foundation. And Mike and I are both board members on the foundation. Intended to educate the public about things that they should be knowledgeable about, things like direct primary care issues or alternatives to Obamacare. A lot of the problems in healthcare, like the health information boondoggle,
information technology problem in this country, where the information technology as a concept is a great thing, the execution, unfortunately, is leaving something to be desired.
So we will explore that in coming weeks. Health
yes.
information technology, things like tort reform, which is really one of the biggest cost drivers in healthcare, and we've got exciting shows planned, which you'll hear about soon. But we'd like to focus the rest of this show on one of the most important, one of the most provocative and controversial problems that has hit the news in the last couple of years about healthcare, and that's this VA healthcare crisis. This is really a terrible problem.
It's an awful problem. It really is. Before we get fully into that, I want to extend an invitation to the listeners. We would like to hear from you. If you hear something on the show that you like, or even something you don't like, or even on this first day of the show, just email us and let us know that you're listening. The address is doctorslounge.webradio@gmail.com. So please let us hear from you. So on to the VA scandal. For those of you who are not fully familiar with it, and there probably are not many, but we'll review what's going on with some of this. This began several days ago with a story that broke out of the Phoenix VA hospital where 40 veterans died languishing on a waiting list waiting for treatment. And the more folks looked, the more they found. There were evidence of fraudulent documentation, fudging the data entry in the computer system to make wait times look like they were within the prescribed 2 weeks when in fact it was months, 6 months, maybe more. Additional fraudulent documentation aimed at fudging the data on disability claims, where this was supposed to be handled in a timely manner, where these claims were actually taking years, and they were fudging that data by re-entering the cases into the system to make it look new. On this past Monday, an audit was released by the VA Inspector General showing that more than 57,000 veterans have been waiting up to 3 months or longer for medical appointments, and an additional 64,000 veterans who have enrolled in the VA system who have never seen a physician.
Wow, this is just unbelievable. But it really isn't unbelievable to doctors, and in the doctors' lounges around the country,
absolutely.
Doctors have been talking about VA issues for decades. And in fact, I wrote a piece that appeared in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago that has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of play. And it's entitled Doctors War Stories from VA Hospitals. And I know, Mike, you've trained in a couple of VA hospitals. Which VAs did you train in?
When I was a medical student, I trained in the VA in Durham, North Carolina, and as a resident at Vanderbilt in Nashville, the Nashville VA. Both of those hospitals are on the academic campus.
Okay, and same with me. I trained as a resident in San Diego at the San Diego VA, which is really one of the nicer VAs in the country. In medical school, I was at the San Antonio VA, and what we saw as residents or as medical students was a culture that was really typical of any kind of bureaucracy, and it was really so bad in terms of trying to get our patients taken care of that we ran into roadblocks along the way. And I wrote about that. I had gotten stories from people who were willing to share their experience and allow me to put their name on it, and I wrote about that in the Wall Street Journal piece. One of the doctors is one of our docs for patient care, Dr. Scott Barber, and what I shared his experience at the Miami VA when he and his fellow resident were told that they couldn't increase the number of patients that they were seeing in the operating room. So they took it upon themselves to clean the operating rooms between cases to speed things up, to get patients transported from the surgical floor into the operating room, because doctors all know it takes forever to get a patient moved in a hospital. And they were able to get on two or three or sometimes four extra cases in a day, which is monumental at a VA hospital.
Well, double the volume.
Yes. And instead of being commended for it, they were called into the chief of surgery's office, and they were basically reprimanded because they were working so hard, they were making the people who worked at the VA look bad. Plus, they were creating extra work for the nurses who had to take care of more postoperative patients. And so this is the experience that I shared, the inside baseball information that all of us know has been going on for years.
Well, think about this for a minute, Hal. I mean, this is doctors, this is MDs picking up the broom, picking up the mop, and cleaning the operating room between cases, you know, out of their devotion to the patients. They're literally doing somebody else's job for them. And how can you do anything besides reward somebody for that kind of behavior? And yet, you know, because it rocks the boat, and because it brings change to a situation where lots of folks benefit from the status quo, they get their wrists slapped. It's awful. So, you know, the sad thing here, Hal, is this is not new. I mean, you know, there's a lot of politicians out there, you know, expressing shock, outrage. But, you know, it turns out that, you know, the history of the VA goes back all the way to 1921 when the Veterans Administration was created as the Veterans Bureau, and it immediately became corrupt. In fact, Shinseki is not the fourth VA administrator, not the first VA administrator to resign, but the fourth to resign.
So why are we just hearing about this now? Well, we'll talk about that in the next segment.
Spring is in the air, literally. So follow Sniffles to Atlanta Center for breathing easy. Weeds, spores, grass, pollen. Airborne allergen levels are through the roof, putting your allergies into overdrive. It's time to followsniffles.com.
Follow me and breathe easy.
End your annual ritual of taking medication to alleviate facial pressure, facial pain, congestion, and headaches by treating the problem, not the symptom. Balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day. FollowSniffles.com.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Your severe sinus and nasal symptoms gone once and for all. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again. Call us at 404-591-9100. That's 404-591-9100.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Doctor's Lounge, brought to you by Docs for Patient Care Foundation. Docs for Patient Care Foundation is a non-for-profit 501c3 organization that's dedicated to healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient care relationship.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. I'm Dr. Hal Schurz.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak.
And we are inviting you to speak in the lounge with us today about the VA crisis. This has just been an issue that won't quit, Mike. It's something that every day we're hearing new things about. But why are we now just hearing about the VA issues?
Well, a lot of folks have offered the VA as the shining example of government-fostered, government-sponsored health care. And it turns out that those people are right. It is a shining example of government-sponsored, government-fostered health care, for better or for worse. And finally, some whistleblowers have broken the code of silence and have come forward to bring these facts to light. And, of course, once you hear the first, that sort of opens the door to find out more and more information. I don't think we're through yet, Hal.
Oh, I know we're not through. This is just the tip of the iceberg, I'm afraid. You know, this is something that has been going on for decades. And, you know, right now what we're focusing on is a scandal that started out because of access and because of fudged data that had to do with incentives. And I think we'll talk about that in a few minutes. We'll get into why that has happened. But the whole VA system, which Paul Krugman has said is the best system that exists, so why don't we just turn all of healthcare into the VA? And I think that the real interesting piece of information out of all this, that you can just, you know, Occam's razor, you know, the best way between two points is a straight line. Why are most doctors opposed to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it's because we know how it's going to look. I mean, this whole situation with the VA is the perfect example of what Obamacare, what socialized medicine is going to look like if you create these conditions and give it enough time.
And not only that, but 70% or more of doctors in this country have trained at VA hospitals. They've spent time as medical students or as residents at VA hospitals. So we have witnessed firsthand what's gone on at the VA for decades, and we all know what happens when it's a bureaucracy-run system, and none of us want to work for the VA or at the VA. We don't want any part of it. And that, I'm afraid, is the road that we're traveling down with Affordable Care Act, because what that is going to eventually lead to is a single payer. And for those of you who don't understand what that means, it means the VA. It means the British healthcare system. It means whatever system there is that has to do with rationing care because of a certain amount of money. But this problem, Mike, isn't really a money problem, is it, at the VA?
No, it's not a money problem. And in fact, spending at the VA has gone up 27% between 2008 and 2012 to a budget of over $150 billion, which calculates out to about $6,000 per veteran.
Doesn't that make it the second largest federal bureaucracy at that budget, like I think right behind the Defense Department?
At least.
Yeah, and you know what's really stunning? Lee Habib wrote an article in the National Review Online, which was very interesting with some of the statistics. The VA now employs more than 300,000 people, and in that 300,000, what is absolutely stunning is the fact that only 5,100 primary care doctors are employed by the VA. Think about that.
Would you call that a bureaucracy-heavy organization?
No kidding. So despite the fact that the bureaucracy has increased almost 100% over the past 14 years, the number of VA doctors has increased only by 9%. So you talk about an access problem for the veterans. I don't think that you really have to look, you know, very much farther than that statistic.
Well, and the VA hasn't even spent all the money that it's had allocated to it. I mean, I don't understand a congressman like Jay Rockefeller coming out and declaring that the VA is underfunded and overwhelmed when the money is there to spend. They could hire the doctors. I don't understand why they don't.
That's right. And in the Washington Examiner just this past week, Byron York reported that the VA actually had a $450 million carryover from fiscal year 2014 to 2015. And the year before that, their carryover was $543 million. So this is something that it's really not a money problem at all. There have been a number of editorials that have pointed this out, that throwing more money at the VA would simply reward more failure. It wouldn't fix the problem.
Well, gosh, Hal, how many doctors could you hire for $450 million? You think you could solve that long wait time with that kind of money if you just hired physicians?
Well, you know, it's not so much just, you know, a money problem, although this is always the answer in Washington. It's to throw more money at problems or to fire people. And Secretary Shinseki, who was fired, that's not the answer. But the answer to this problem isn't going to be one person being fired or one person being hired. The Obama administration offered this job last week to Toby Cosgrove, who turned it down. He runs the Cleveland Clinic. He's a heart surgeon. He's an Air Force surgeon, you know, decorated Vietnam veteran. But he runs one of the most successful healthcare businesses in the world. And so he's being asked to come in and fix the VA, and he's looking at the VA and he's saying, uh-uh.
Not solvable.
Not solvable, because this is not going to be a problem that you solve simply by firing a few people or throwing money at it. The problem is the basic philosophy of bureaucracy.
Hal, this involves dozens of hospitals and hundreds, if not thousands, of employees who either by their own volition or by coercion from above have been, coerced into fudging data and doing things to make the performance look much better by reporting than it actually is.
So is that basically pay for performance, Mike?
This is a pay for performance system. And that's the problem when you get into pay for performance. And let's just back up a little bit and talk about that for those of you that aren't familiar with this idea. Beginning in about the mid-2000s, about 2005, this whole concept of pay for performance came forward out of the notion that you could improve healthcare by incentivizing providers to do what somebody considers to be the right thing. And the rationale is hard to argue. If you want behavior to change, why not incentivize it? And like in so many other places, you know, the intent may be noble. The implementation is difficult and not impossible because, you know, how do you reduce quality of care? Something as ethereal as that, especially, you know, in the doctor-patient relationship, into, you know, an arbitrary discrete data point, which in this case was, you know, how long you wait to get a visit. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, that's not a bad parameter. I mean, part of quality of care is to get a timely appointment. But the mistake that the VA made is I violated a cardinal rule of pay for performances, which is that you need to come up with a goal that is attainable. And according to the VA audit that came out on Monday, the goal of making an appointment for a veteran within 2 weeks of the request was simply not an attainable goal, and they called it, I quote, an organizational leadership failure. So when you put VA administrators that are already in a culture of corruption and cover-up and you put a pay-for-performance parameter that's not attainable in front of them, they have three choices. They can do the best they can and ultimately fail because the parameter is not reasonable. They can openly admit that it doesn't work and try to whistleblow on this whole thing, but we know what happens to them, don't we, Hal?
Yeah.
You know, they get transferred, they get demoted, they get suspended, you know, or you are gradually coerced into becoming a participant, willing or not, in the fraud scheme.
Well, you know, this is when you say about the culture at the VA and that of the whistleblowers being afraid to come out, this is something, another story that was shared with me by another doctor, where they were trying to help the speed up a clinic, and some of the one of the employees tried to step up and help them do extra work during their lunch hour, and they were reprimanded, and in fact they were suspended for 2 weeks because they were doing more than they were supposed to do. They were going outside of the norm of the VA system and trying to help speed things up and help with that backlog. And so the culture there at the VA has always been a top-down, repressive type of organization. But I don't want to paint this with a broad brush, because I think that what I don't want people to think is that everybody who works at the VA are bad people or they have bad intent. That's not the case. It's absolutely not true at all. And there are all of the doctors who've received their training there. They've been mentored by many good people who really had the best motives. There were nurses who were devoted and dedicated. There were people who worked in other departments who shared the same kind of concern. But it's the system that was set up that put roadblocks in front of people who even cared, that made it difficult for them to do their jobs, like the people who draw blood. They would only have one blood draw a day, and that's not how an acute care hospital is supposed to work. Or people who work in X-ray file rooms. Back then we had X-ray file rooms or medical record rooms. Those people, you know, they you know, were not
there was a lot of devoted folks there, Hal.
And
I was concerned when I did the research for this segment today that in my own memory of working at the VA, there were a small but very significant number of folks who were answering a call to our veterans who, you know, put their lives on the line for us, and then, you know, we are certainly morally obligated to them to give them the care that they need. And these folks, you know, felt the need to work within the system as best they could. And a lot of times, you know, we would reach out to each other as groups to try to do the best we can, understanding that there was a top-down bureaucracy imposing certain limitations that, you know, nobody could work their way around.
Well, you know, I think that the losers in this whole affair are the veterans who are right now suffering, who've suffered really for years, but right now are we're hearing about it, and we need to address that. But when we come back in the next segment, I think what I'd like to talk about is the problems with reporting of data, and we'll explore that next.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF A nonprofit organization is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Membership. Are you an IHC member? Access to the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism's breaking news, industry trends, expert blogs, and networking with IHC's industry-wide member community. IHC membership puts you at the focal point of the dynamic health and benefit industry, allowing you to join the conversation and collaborate with industry stakeholders and your peers. Your IHC membership includes a subscription to Healthcare Consumerism Solutions Magazine, Healthcare Exchange Solutions Magazine, annual publications Healthcare Solutions Superstars, and Healthcare Solutions Outlook, a free white paper, and much more. Sign up as a free IHC member or $99 premium IHC member today at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. You are in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. In this segment, we're going to continue our conversation about the VA scandal. Hal?
Well, Mike, I think that the data that we're now seeing come out from all the hospitals around the country, which is not isolated just to Phoenix or Miami, but it's all over.
It's everywhere.
It is. And we this data is questionable data. It's very troubling. And one of the things that we learn in medical school, which is something that's drummed into us from the very first day that we get to take care of a patient, is that doctors make mistakes. Doctors make errors. And that's, you know, just the nature of what we do. That's human nature.
We're human beings taking care of human beings.
So there are two types of errors. There are errors of omission, which means that you forget something. You may overlook a lab report. You may forget to look up something. And so an error is made because of that. And when that happens, I know if I have been browbeaten for that, and I'm sure you have, and every doctor that we know has experienced that at some point in their training, and that's part of training. But an error of omission is forgivable. Then you have an error of commission, and an error of commission is an intentional error. It means that you are intentionally misleading or lying or fudging. And an error of commission is unforgivable, because once you make an error of commission, you have breached sacred trust between you and your patient. And there is no forgiving that. There's really no turning back. Once you've gone down that road, once you've experienced the evil side of the force,
yes,
you can't be turned around, and nobody can you can't be trusted beyond that point.
Well, the error of commission speaks of intent. Right? The error of omission, where you fail to do something that you're supposed to do, can be an error as opposed to an act of malfeasance.
So aren't we seeing really at the VA, which is a whole institution, it's many institutions, it's 153 acute care hospitals, aren't we seeing in the VA what right now this is a massive institutional error of commission?
It has to be, Hal. It has to be. You can't accidentally create a secret wait list of patients who are waiting for treatment. You can't accidentally coerce your appointment schedulers to fudge data entry on an appointment screen to put a fraudulent date that the patient wants a visit, so that the reports automatically read that you're doing everything the way you're supposed to when you're not. So this is an error of commission. This is a clear act of evil intent.
Is this a crime, do you think, Mike? You know, they're talking right now. There's a reaction. Every time something happens that's newsworthy, not just in the VA but in general, somebody is to blame. And in this circumstance, we're trying to point the finger at individuals who are responsible for this. And in fact, this is breaking news yesterday. The VA is now under investigation in Phoenix by the FBI, and they're going to look at prosecuting individuals and holding them accountable. Is this really a single person's fault?
No, certainly not. I don't know that you could prosecute or fire or demote or otherwise punish enough individuals to make a change in the system. The system is the way it is because it has no competition and it has no real accountability beyond these arbitrary pay-for-performance measures, which are easy to fudge. And when you put human beings in that kind of environment for long enough, you're going to get this to happen. So the idea that you're going to fire 1 or 10 or 50 individuals is kind of like cutting a weed off at the surface of the ground and letting the roots stay. It's going to grow back.
So the problems that we're hearing about, which are the most horrible and egregious, are the ones that have to do with long waits that have resulted in the deaths of our veterans. And we're hearing now about not just the problems with long waits, but the Wall Street Journal reported this week about problems with clinical outcomes. You know, for years, the VA has been favorably compared with the care that's been given in the private sector. And they are held out as good or better than the private sector healthcare outcomes, which is part of the reason why the enthusiasts of Obamacare have used the VA as the shining light of where we need to go as a system in healthcare. But I'm really concerned that if they're fudging data about wait times, what's to prevent them from fudging clinical data? And I have to say that this is something that I'm extremely concerned about.
Absolutely. And if you're lying about one thing, what stops you from lying about everything else? And Hal, I think you've got some data in front of you there talking about some very nasty violations of proper clinical practice. The one that I remember the most is from the VA in my hometown of Pittsburgh. In 2011, a story came out about an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. It's bad enough that it happened in the first place, but the real sad part was the cover-up, where this went on for at least a year, if not longer. The administrators knew about it, and nobody was talking.
That's right. And the Wall Street Journal, in their article, reported on 7 VAs that were underperforming VAs, and they were all around the country. It wasn't just isolated to one area. And what they were reporting were substandard data for congestive heart failure. And their data shows that the deaths in some of these institutions, the death rates from these problems exceeded the norms. And this was surprising. And I think that as this goes on, we're going to hear more and more about outcomes, not just data about weights, but actually clinical outcomes. And I don't think it's going to be all too good.
No, it's not going to be good. In a way, this whole controversy kind of breaks the logjam in one of the arms of the debate about Obamacare and socialized medicine. Again, Hal, because supporters of Obamacare point to the VA and say, this is our great shining example. Look at the VA. And the docs say, yeah, look at the VA. And at that point, you can't carry the argument much further because the supporters look at the VA and say it's great. The docs who look at the VA because we've worked there, we've seen it from the inside, look at it and say it's terrible. And at that point, you can't take the conversation much further until something like this happens.
So this is sort of vindication for what we as doctors have seen for decades.
We've seen this all along. I mean, in during training, if you're in an academic medical center, it's a stark contrast. You know, we do these things called rotations, Hal, right, where you spend 3 months in your academic medical center and then maybe 3 months at the VA medical center, and you swing back and forth between environments that in many ways couldn't be more different. In the academic medical center, I won't say everything runs perfectly, but you have a level of devotion from top to bottom. You have, you know, a full staff of academicians doing what they do best. And then, you know, at the first day of the next month, you're at the VA, and it's like a whole different world.
It is. The at academic centers, we know that it's still difficult to be as productive as we both are in private practice.
Correct.
But at the VA, the VA takes it to an extreme because the culture of not wanting to work too hard is part of the fabric. And so the operating rooms, for example, and I wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal piece, we were prohibited from operating beyond 3 p.m. And we were encouraged to start slowing down actually at about 1 o'clock, and we couldn't put on a case that was going to run over. If we gave a time estimate that was incorrect and it ran over, we would face incredible retribution from the head nurse at the VA. So we were able to only put on one large case. We put on a few small cases, and you, as a chief resident, I know you had a list of patients who needed surgery. I know I did as a chief resident running the urology practice at the VA in San Diego. We had waiting lists. The waiting lists are not new. The waiting lists are part of the VA. And because we were only given a certain amount of operating time, we had to ration care. We had to decide, okay, this patient has prostate cancer, but it's a slow-growing cancer. So we could put off this patient's surgery maybe for a month so that we can get on the kidney cancer or the bladder cancer, which needed to come out right away. Could you imagine if you're sitting there with a cancer that needs to come out and you're being told you can't put the surgery on because there's just not enough room on the schedule?
Well, and it's awful. And the reason that they have to put up with it is, again, because there's no competition. There's no alternative. I mean, imagine what would happen in our world now, Hal, if we had to tell a patient you had to wait a month or two or three or longer for surgery. Well, that patient would go somewhere else.
So is the VA a snapshot, Mike, of what we can expect with a single-payer system, which is, I think, where we are headed on this road?
Absolutely. You know, in a single-payer system, there's no competition, there's no incentive, no true incentive to perform, because you know that those patients have to wait for you because they have nowhere else to go. And the longer you're in a system where you don't have competition and you don't have choice, the more deeply entrenched this culture is going to become. So, yes, clearly the VA is a harbinger of things to come if we stay on the path that we're on.
And we know what that is about just by looking across the ocean, looking at Great Britain. And they have had socialized health care since the 1940s. And they're finding that it's just not working, and they're moving away from it just at the same time that we're moving towards it. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Absolutely. I mean, there's just no other way to look at it.
So, you know, I think that there are solutions for the VA system, and in the next segment, you know, I think we will devote the rest of the show to talking about how can we fix this problem, because you know, it needs to be fixed. I don't think that Washington's solutions that we are hearing about are the answer, and we have to offer the vets something more tangible than throwing money at it and firing people. So we'll be back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio in just 1 minute. Thank you.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that chronic nasal congestion, a decreased sense of smell, and asthma can be signs of allergies? Allergies are caused when the body is exposed to things you breathe in or eat that the body does not like. The body's immune system reacts and attacks it, what it perceives to be the enemy, even if it causes no harm, like pet dander or dust. This leads to swelling. In the nose, this causes congestion. In the bowel, it causes stomach bloating and diarrhea. In the lung, it causes shortness of breath and wheezing. And in the skin, it causes hives and itching. The first line of defense against allergy is avoidance. Dustproofing, washing pets, and keeping them out of the bedroom can help with environmental causes. For food allergies, keeping a diary of things eaten and reaction to them is helpful. Allergy testing is less time-consuming and is a safe and effective way to identify allergies. For a complete evaluation, you should see your allergy specialist.
This is Michael Gannot with the Middle East Research Center Limited, bringing you insight to Israel, the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security, every Sunday at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm Dr. Hal Schurz.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchek.
And we are exploring the VA problems with health care. And we've spent the last 45 minutes really building up to this point in the show, I think. We've talked about why we're here, what the problems are, the fact that this has really been something that is not news for the majority of doctors in this country.
That's right.
It may be news to the public, but most doctors in this country trained at VA hospitals. And so we've known about what goes on at the VA, and what we're hearing right now, I think, is it's about time, is all I can say.
Definitely. And you know, I'll throw some numbers out to think about when we're talking about what do you do about this. It is a little bit gratifying to see Congress at least make a short-term move here. Both, I think, the House and Senate have passed similar bills. They need to be resolved in committee, but at least they're giving some lip service to the idea of allowing veterans to get care outside the VA if they're having to wait. And in concept, that's not a bad idea.
But Mike, veterans always had that ability to get care. They've outsourced care before. The problem is that it's only in very small pockets and in special instances that has happened. And the problem
that's
is
correct.
We
need a bigger solution. We need a bigger solution. So here's some numbers to think about. Now, if you look up the annual budget of the VA, you can find numbers ranging from $100 billion to $153 billion. Probably that $153 billion number is the most accurate. So if you do a little bit of long division and divide that by about 22.8 million veterans, you get a number of about $6,000-$7,000 per veteran.
That's tremendous.
To spend on health care for those folks. And it makes me wonder, and I'm not a policy expert on this. I don't pretend to know exactly how to crunch these numbers. But I think if you look at that $7,000 per veteran figure, you've got to ask yourself the question, could we take that money and get veterans care by some other method besides a single-payer socialized model?
Well, we can give them a card, couldn't we? Visa debit card with their health savings account card, and let them go to the community and get their health care, just like those of us who have health savings accounts or who have indemnity insurance can go to a doctor and get it debited off a card.
I would think $7,000 would buy a lot of health insurance for an individual on the private market.
And the system is really a mess, but that might be a immediate solution, immediate relief for that 120,000 veteran waiting list that we're hearing about. But, you know, I think that the problem beside outsourcing is to get the Veterans Administration, the Veterans Affairs, out of the acute care business. They just don't do that well. I think that the proof of that is going to be apparent very soon as more and more of these reports come out from the hospitals that the Wall Street Journal reported, such as in Augusta, Georgia, in Little Rock, Arkansas, Oklahoma City, Phoenix, Puget Sound, Seattle. All of those VAs have underperformed. But what we need to do is we need to shut down the acute care system that the VA has and convert all of those VA hospitals into what the VA does well, which is rehab. We've got a whole population of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who have special needs that
Prosthetics, all that stuff, they do very well.
And the community doesn't do that as well as the VA, so
yes,
that they can do very well. Mental health,
absolutely.
Post-traumatic stress disorders. Again, community doctors are not as well trained, I don't think, as the psychiatrists at the VA hospital.
Oh, agreed, and it makes sense because they have the breadth and depth of experience. That's where the PTSD disease lives in the veterans population.
Right.
Limb injuries. Those are war wounds. So it makes sense that the VA would be uniquely qualified to care for those folks because that's where they are.
And so converting the VAs into that type of system and also long-term care facilities, which are unfortunately are needed for a certain percentage of our disabled veterans. If you converted those hospitals into those types of facilities and outsourced the acute care to the community, that I believe, despite the previous VA data, I believe does better than the VA does. And I think if you do that, that will be the solution. But I don't think that's enough. We've got a culture at the VA, the bureaucratic culture that we have talked about for the last hour and has been shown by many people now in the media, that this culture, this top-down culture, is just not consistent with the delivery of healthcare. And now with the pay for performance or the incentives that the VA has built in, we're seeing the worst in people. And so you've got to hold people accountable, but you can't have the foxes guarding the hen house. You have to have them accountable to some other agency, whether that's state medical boards or some other outside facility.
Or perhaps ultimately freedom of choice with the folks who are seeking the care in the first place. If you have a choice and you can go somewhere else for your care because the wait is too long or you don't like the care you receive or you're having to wait a long time for an operation, then have the option of going elsewhere, just like our own patients do if we were to not, serve them in a timely manner with quality care. And let's be clear, Hal. This is not a Democratic problem.
Exactly.
This is not a Republican problem. This has been going on for almost 100 years. The Veterans Bureau was founded in 1921. That's 7 years short of a century. And from the historical accounts I've looked at, it took about a week for this thing to become corrupt after it was created. And 9 years after the Veterans Bureau was created, it was abolished, and it was replaced by the Veterans Administration. And since then, four now heads of the VA have had to resign in disgrace because either issues related to quality of care, issues of disability support, or corruption and fraud and misallocation of funds.
Well, I'm glad that you said that because really this is not a partisan issue. It is a bureaucratic issue. And it's the problem when you have a bureaucracy that is in charge of something that's essential to everybody, which is healthcare. And running a bureaucracy from a central office, from a top-down system, and telling people what they should have done to their health and telling them what they can get, how much they can get, when they can get it, where they can get it, just doesn't work. People need to be in charge of their own health care. They and their doctors make those decisions better than a central organization does.
Absolutely. And the problem is if you don't have that freedom of choice, then these pay-for-performance measures, are a weak, anemic Band-Aid. And any kind of measure that you try to put in place to reduce, you know, this ethereal product of quality of care down to checking a bunch of boxes or looking at simple parameters just doesn't work. And the scary part, Hal, is this is not just a VA issue, not just a government issue. This pay-for-performance thing is coming to the entire practice of medicine. This has been signed on to by the AMA, by specialty organizations, and everyone has pretty much culturally accepted the notion that pay-for-performance is coming. The train's left the station, and there's nothing that you can do about it except, you know, cooperate with it or come up with your own parameters. But even in the absence of fraud, Hal, it invites gaming of the system. And if you choose to measure a few parameters of quality or something that you're arbitrarily deciding defines quality, then everybody games the system to serve those guidelines and other parts of the system suffer. So, for example, doctors will avoid sicker patients because it makes their statistics look bad, or they will try to push patients, you know, to other providers if they don't want to take care of them, because it now becomes a matter of an individual statistics rather than the team effort. And it just doesn't work. It's very hazardous.
And Medicare, for example, will penalize doctors who are overutilizers, for example.
Yes.
So, or who readmit patients to hospitals. And so you're going to have perverse disincentives that are not aligned with the best in for the patients. And so I think you're absolutely right, Mike.
We have all this crazy stuff. We have the 30-day readmission rule. We have this new thing called the 2-midnight rule. And that, you know, I just got phone calls about from the hospital I work at yesterday saying that now they've had to reconfigure the EMR to the electronic medical record system to accommodate the requirements of the 2-midnight rule. So everything that you learned about how to
What is the 2-midnight rule?
The 2-midnight rule says that if you don't keep a patient in the house, in the hospital, for 2 midnights, that you get paid at the outpatient rate rather than the inpatient rate. And so now there's a whole host of countermeasures going on within the structures of hospitals to accommodate that. And again, it's wasted money. It's wasted human effort and time.
So really, the VA, again, for our audience, is a snapshot of things to come in healthcare, and I don't think that there's any question that we're heading in the wrong direction, but I'm optimistic. I think that this is something that we can turn in the right direction with enough people being informed about what's going on in healthcare, and that's what we're intending to do in the Doctor's Lounge. And so I hope that you've enjoyed our show today. We are going to have next week as our next guest, Dr. Lee Gross, who is going to come to us from Florida and talk about direct primary care, which is a whole new model of being able to deliver health care to patients who can't afford traditional insurance but yet get good health care. And on future shows, Mike and I will alternate because we have busy clinical practices, and it's really hard for us to get away. So, Mike, why don't you take us out and wrap this up?
Okay. In future shows that I'm going to do, we'll be talking about all of the controversies regarding health information technology, electronic medical records, and go from there. As we close, I'm going to extend the invitation to you again. If you've been kind enough to listen to us, please email us with your thoughts at doctorslounge.webradio@gmail.com. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thank you.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.